I'd like to call to meeting the meeting of Hess at 1:35. All members are present except for Senator Dyson, who's away on business. Well, we have present today Senator Calgary, Senator Thomas, Senator Elton, and myself, Betty Davis. We do have a presentation to be presented on No Child Left Behind today, and that is our main discussion for today. I'm going to ask that we let him complete his presentation before we ask questions. If you would just jot down, just in case you think you might forget the question, so that we can come back, because sometimes you don't get to complete the presentation when we get off on some of the questions. Is there any other comments that need to be made by staff committee members before we get started? If not, we're going to turn it over to you. And would you state your name for the record? And
my name's Les Morse. I'm the Director of Assessment, Accountability, and Information Management at the Alaska Department of Education. And what I'm going to do today is walk through school and district accountability under No Child Left Behind in terms of how we have put that into place in Alaska. And specifically, I'm going to talk about adequate yearly progress, the levels of consequences for schools and districts, and who is responsible for the implementation of those levels of consequences. I'm going to take a look at Alaska results from 2003 to present and talk about our interest in including growth in adequate yearly progress, which is something that has been important to the department here in Alaska and for some time, and we have applied to the U.S. Department of Ed to do that. Also, while I'm walking through here, I'm going to try to touch on things that may be issues that will come up in the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind that would be of interest to Alaska, certainly from the department's perspective, and make sure you're aware of those, and hopefully I'll be able to hit on all of those. Most are contained within here. There are issues outside of this presentation that at the end I will try to remember to mention that are unrelated to my presentation but parts of No Child Left Behind that we think needs to work.
Sounds good.
In the beginning, I'm just going to walk through to, and for some of you, you've probably heard about No Child Left Behind and adequate yearly progress, but I want to just give a quick picture again to refresh your memory about how the process works. With adequate yearly progress, which is the measure of whether students are, whether the schools are performing at the targets they're supposed to, we look at multiple different things. And we look at schools. Every school gets evaluated, every district gets evaluated, and the state, in fact, is evaluated, all using the same methodology. The first piece is participation. We need to ensure that 95% of the students in the school take the test. And that's just to ensure that you have enough, all of the students are there taking it so that it's a true measure of the school and that there are not students being left out of the testing process. Then the school is evaluated for their progress toward meeting the academic targets. And the target is set by the percent of students that are supposed to be proficient on the state test. And we look at language arts and mathematics. The target in the law is called annual measurable objective, but it's simply a target of how many students are supposed to be proficient within that school by percent. And then we also look at graduation rate and attendance rate. And in a few slides, I'm going to speak to those specifically and how that looks in Alaska. So that's what we look at when we're evaluating for adequate yearly progress. One of the things, and this is probably my first opportunity to talk about something that probably needs some level of adjustment in No Child Left Behind. The targets, again, are what percent of students are supposed to be proficient in the school. So in 2001, 2002, 64.3% or 0.03% of the students were to be proficient in language arts. In mathematics, 54.86%. If it was less than that, they didn't meet adequate yearly progress. If it was more than that, then they met. It increases over time. And as you can see, in 2013-14, it's 100%. Obviously, we don't want to have a goal of less than 100% of our students becoming proficient. However, on that magic year of 100% being proficient might be rather challenging. That's assuming, you know, a limited English proficient student who arrives in a third grade year that year, new immigrant, is supposed to be proficient that year. We think that some language that looks at all students progressing toward proficiency, so that by the time they leave the school district, there is a target of all students being proficient, might be more reasonable language. And some of the proposals we've submitted to the U.S. Department of Education concerning looking at growth of individual students, we think would accomplish that. To date, our proposals have not been accepted. But we also think that could be some language that's written strongly into the reauthorization. Adequate yearly progress looks at a number of things. Even mine, I said we look at participation, we look at performance in math, language arts, and we look at graduation rate. First, you look at the overall school. How did the school do? Then you break that all those categories down into racial and ethnic groups. So we're looking at how did all of the racial ethnic groups in the school do, and how did the students who were economically disadvantaged, limited English proficient, and special education do. And all of those groups, or subgroups as they're often referred to, have to meet those targets, which are the annual measurable objective, the number that have to be proficient in the content areas. And they all have to meet the 95% participation. And then we look also, again, as I said, at graduation rate. And if a school doesn't have a graduation rate, for example, if it's an elementary school, we look at their attendance rate. And I just want to spend a moment on the graduation rate to make sure it's understood how we calculate the graduation rate. What we're really looking at is how many of the number of ninth graders who entered the school 4 years earlier graduated. That's what we're looking at in our graduation rate. Years ago, we looked at how many seniors at the beginning of the year graduated at the end of the year. Well, now we're looking at how many make it through the full system. Those students who drop out are incorporated into the graduation rate calculation. But the rates, the graduation and the dropout rate, are different. Our graduation rate runs about 60% in the state of Alaska. That doesn't mean that 40% of our students dropped out, however. That means that 40% of the students did not graduate on time. So in there are the dropouts. Also in there are the students who are going to go on maybe for a fifth year in school, or students who are in special education have the right to attend school longer and will go beyond their fourth year. So again, 60% is the graduation rate. That doesn't mean the dropout is 40%. What we look at is a yearly dropout, and our yearly dropout usually is around 5% or 6% of our students leave in grades 7 through 12. So there's a dropout rate, it's a problem, but it isn't the inverse of the graduation rate. And then the attendance rate is what is used, again, for a judgment of schools that do not have students in the 12th grade. This gives me an opportunity here to also point out something that we think is problematic in the law, but this gives you a picture of what we're looking at when we look at how a school does. I'm just going to walk through that first line at the top where it says school as a whole. In this case, at the school as a whole level, there were 538 students. And in this example I'm using, and this is just an example, we have a column for participation. If in this particular school they met the 95% participation at the school as a whole and all of those subgroups, and that's all the subgroups that we look at. If it says NA, which it does under American Indian in this example, it means they did not have students in that population group. Under language arts, you can see that in most areas they met. One area they did not. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. So they are above the target of 70.03%, except in one area. And in mathematics, they met across the board in all of the subgroups. and then the other indicator they've also met. So let me walk back to language arts and go down to the second to the last row, which is students with disabilities in language arts is at 50% of those students are proficient. The target is 70.03% proficient. So they missed in one subgroup. And the way our system works, if they populated all those cells, there are 31 ways to miss adequate yearly progress. This particular example school missed in just one of those 31 ways. There might be another school, and we have them in the state, that might miss in 18 or in 25 of the different areas. Yet the way the law currently is structured, the consequences are the same for a school that misses in one versus a school that misses in 18. We are, in Alaska, or at the department, are strongly advocating that the in the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, there be what we would call differentiated consequences. If a school, such as this example up here, misses, as it's outlined here, perhaps some targeted interventions of looking at the program of language arts for students with disabilities would be appropriate. But many of the other consequences that come with the law may very well not be appropriate and may not affect the change that's desired in the school. So we think some differentiated consequences that target what would cause a school to improve may be more beneficial in the law, and we think that needs to be addressed in the reauthorization. The way the consequences work in the law and the way that we've followed this in the state of Alaska is the district is responsible for ensuring that the school implements the appropriate consequences. The state is not in charge of that. We lay out the regulations, but the district is responsible for making sure the school follows the consequences. And there's levels of consequences, and they progress. At level one, a school is put into what's called alert status. They haven't met adequate yearly progress. Level two, they have to then begin offering choice, if choice is available in many of our areas, it's not. And then it goes up to level five, where they would have restructuring at the school level to change the governance of the school. Again, those consequences must be implemented, and the district must ensure they're implemented. Once a school reaches level two, meaning they've not met adequate yearly progress for 2 years in a row, the only way they're removed from those sets of consequences is to, in fact, turn around and meet adequate yearly progress 2 years in a row. If they meet for 1 year, they stay at the level they're at. They don't advance, but they don't get removed from the consequences. So if they were at level three, they would have to meet. And let's say they're at level three and they meet. Then they stay at level three. But to be removed and go back to not having any level, they would have to meet one more year. For the district, the state is responsible for ensuring that the, should say district, I apologize, that first line instead of school should say district. So the state is responsible for ensuring that the district implements the appropriate consequences. And they have a level system set out there too. You miss for 1 year, you're in level one, 2 years, level two, up to 4 years. There are districts that have missed for more than 4 years. We just, our level system in terms of the consequences goes up to four levels. After that, we'll indicate the school or district is at level four and has been there for 2 years. Again, same system applies. The district would have to meet adequate yearly progress for 2 years in a row to be removed from that list. Now, if you mix this along with the requirement that they get toward 100%, it's going to come a point where it would be very difficult for a district or a school to meet, because they'd have to have 100%, or in the next few years, very near that, of their students proficient for them to meet adequate yearly progress. And that's why, again, we think that something that said students showing individual growth toward proficiency would make more sense. I want to look at Alaska's progress since the law has been implemented, because there has been some growth. And so what I have in this slide shows 2003 to 2006, we've had 4 years, shows the percent of schools meeting and the percent not meeting. In 2003, 42% met. In 2004, 58, 05, 59, and 06, 62. There was a change in the rules between 03 and 04 that had us calculate things differently. So I can't, we wouldn't attribute that 42 to 58 as all progress. I would attribute probably almost 12% of that as a change in how we calculated things. So it would be more likely that that was about a 4% gain that year rather than that amount of gain. But you can clearly see in 04, 05, and 06, there's been a gradual improvement in the years that there hasn't been a change in how we've calculated the adequate yearly progress. This is just another way to look at this. This is the percentage of schools that missed in language arts or math by subgroup. And if I can just walk through again the first line at the top. And I only used 04, 05, and 06 this time because as you meant in the previous slide, I mentioned in 03 things were calculated differently. And so it made more sense just to use the 3 years that the calculation was consistent. So what this is saying is in 2004, 19.7% of our schools missed adequate yearly progress because of the performance of the whole school in terms of math or language arts or perhaps the combination of the two. Then in 2005, 15.6% missed because of that. We walk down to the last column here, 13.3% of our schools in 2004 missed adequate yearly progress because of limited English proficient student performance. 2005, it was 19.7% missed for that reason. In 2006, 8.5% missed. So you can see that there are fewer are missing, and therefore it's another way to look at some improvements in this particular area where the subgroups are improving. The one thing that we monitor for at the department is see if kids are shifting from subgroup to subgroup or if limited English drops dramatically one year or the other. And at this point in Alaska, I don't see those kinds of shifts occurring in any way that would cause me to be alarmed that someone is moving students around inappropriately into subgroups. We also have some very strong ways to identify these groups. So again, yet another way to look at this. Keep in mind I said there are 31 ways to miss. Well, this looks at in 2004 and 2006 and the gain over those 2 years. In 2004, if we go to the very bottom of this column, 3 schools missed for 15 reasons. We went back to that 31 reasons. 3 schools missed for 15 reasons. In 2006, we didn't have any school miss for 15 or more reasons. The other thing, if you look at this, go up to the first one, in 2004, it was, and you add the 1, 2, and 3, how many missed in just 1 or 2 or 3 areas, we see more missing just in one category than we did in the more categories. So we see fewer schools are missing for multiple reasons, and this has been another way for us to look at this in terms of are they improving in some subgroups. Even though the school is still missing overall, they are improving and they're missing for fewer reasons. This takes a look at our districts and how our districts are doing in terms of their performance this last year. Again, I mentioned that a district that misses 1 year is in level 1, 2 years level 2, 4 years is obviously level 4. We had 3 districts miss for the first time last year or be at level 1. 8 districts missed 2 consecutive years, 3 districts missed, or excuse me, 10 districts missed 3 consecutive years, and then 11 districts missed for 4 consecutive years. Of those 11, 2 had been at level 4 for 2 years, and 2 had been there for 3 3 years. Something that Alaska, this is one of the areas of the law, No Child Left Behind, that the Department of Education here in Alaska feels the most strongly about. And that is, we want to see growth included into the law. Right now, there's what's called an improvement provision in the law. It's called Safe Harbor. And what that does is it says, how much did the third, fourth, and fifth graders this year improve compared to the third, fourth, and fifth graders last year? And as you'll can see by that, they're different students. We're not looking at the same students in this scenario. The fifth graders have gone on to the sixth grade. New second graders have come in. So a third of these students are new students. What Alaska has applied for to the U.S. Department of Education is to use individual student accountability. So we want to look at how did Johnny do this year relative to how Johnny did last year. So if we're looking at a middle school, a 6th, 7th, and 8th grade middle school, we would look at how did those 6th graders do this year relative to how they did last year at whatever school they were in. It wouldn't matter where they were, which is very different than Safe Harbor that, again, looks at different students. In this exam, in the our application, we're asking to look at in same students, how did they do, and that growth should be attributed to that school if those students improved in their performance. We have applied for this and have been told that by April we'll learn if our application to include individual student growth will be approved. And this is just an example of why we think looking at individual student growth is very important. Let's look at two schools. The AMO target. Year one, let's say that's the percent of students proficient within that school, and year two. In school one, it actually declined, but under No Child Left Behind, this school would meet the target. Now, it's an exaggerated example, but these kinds of things can happen. In school B, year one, percent of students proficient, year two, percent of students proficient. That school showed dramatic improvement, but yet they haven't met the target. Without including growth, the way that Alaska's applied for it, this school, number two, may in fact not meet the AMO target or the target for the percent of students proficient. And our proposal would be that that school has shown dramatic improvement and ought to be recognized. And we, again, think this is probably the most significant part of No Child Left Behind that ought to be addressed, and that all states that have the capacity and ability to improve growth ought to be able to do that. Outside of the pieces that I've mentioned in terms of things that we'd like to see changed in the law, another area that is outside of this but yet very important, and I didn't come prepared to speak about that, but I did want to mention other parts of the law that we'd like to see changed. Some of the issues we look at in terms of teacher quality and issues around highly qualified is something that we think needs to be addressed. It doesn't work, yes, especially in some of our very small schools. So at this point, I'll take questions if there are any, and either be able to answer them or get answers back for you.
While they're getting their thoughts together, why don't you speak to the qualified teacher, adequate qualified teachers? How are we doing in that area?
Actually, our districts are doing an excellent job at working to get teachers highly qualified and make sure they meet the requirements. And the intent behind that makes sense. I mean, we want to make sure teachers are instructed by people that know the content. But if you can imagine, and I can imagine it very well, because 21 years ago, I taught in a very small rural village. If you imagine in some of those areas where we have maybe five teachers and two teaching at the high school level, teaching multiple contents, the issue is becoming highly qualified in three or four distinctly different content areas within the time frame that they have to do that. And a district will work to get those teachers there. But in some of those areas, by the time the teacher would be highly qualified in more than one area, let alone three areas, they may move on to another district. So it's a challenge, a particularly large challenge for some of our smallest and more rural districts or small schools within the road system as well. It's not just something that affects bush areas, but it also affects small schools anywhere in the state.
Is that something that has been mentioned to the feds about a possible change since we're up for reauthorization now?
Right. Senator Davis, the department has talked to Senator Murkowski's office and has been working very diligently to see that some legislation is introduced that would address those particular issues. And it is our understanding that Senator Murkowski is introducing or planning and working on writing some legislation to introduce that would address some of these issues. And so I think it's important that we continue to make these points clear and known, but I do believe we have an advocate going to work on that.
Yeah, are there any other questions at this time? Yes, Senator Elton?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Les, slides 7 and 8, and they're on page 4 of the handout here. And then I have a second question that's loosely connected, I guess, to the first one. And this has been an issue for me for a while. You give an example of a school in slide 7 that has 538 students. Let's assume that we have a school with 30 students. And let's assume that you have one student with disabilities. And that school will have that student for 4 years. And there is a likelihood that that student might never meet the adequate yearly progress or the AMO in language arts or mathematics, one or the other. I mean, it just seems to me, especially when you have the consequences that are identified in slide 8, it just seems to me inherently unfair that a school that otherwise is going to be a good school is going to be punished for trying to educate a child who may or may not be able to meet the AMOs. And then there are consequences that go to that school that affect other students. I mean, how do we get beyond that? I mean, given the rigid requirements that the feds apply.
Through the chair, Senator Alton, as I mentioned, this is an area that we really struggle with for some of the reasons that you've just mentioned. So at this point, let me answer your question in two parts. One, what we're doing when they get to the highest levels, because that's when we deal with schools, is when a district is in the same position. Because right now, the way the consequences work, a district has to ensure the school is putting those in place. So I'll talk about what we're doing with districts, and then let me mention what I think could be adjusted in the law to address this, what I see as a problem in the law. First off, when a district is in this kind of a position, what we do is go through an auditing process of the district, and that auditing process guides the actions the department takes when we take action on a district that is in the same position. And the audit is two phases. One is a desk audit, and the other is actually sending people to the district to audit. Well, if in the desk audit what we learned is that this is the only reason that district was in this position, and if they were doing a good job with that individual student or a small group of students and showing progress, we would stop there and tell them, you need to take a look at what you're doing that's successful, even though you're not meeting the target, but you're on the right track, and you need to have that in your district improvement plan, whatever it is. Analyze it. You're on the right track. And we would not send a live audit team out there, because the answer probably isn't sitting here in Juneau by going out in that particular situation. However, adjusting the law so that the law allows that sort of make sense approach with all of the schools and would make sense to us. And that's, I guess, the second part of my answer is that's one area where we think the law has to be change. There needs to be a differentiated set of consequences. In that particular situation, if those students are showing growth individually, improving, it doesn't make sense for those consequences. So the questions you raise are the ones we've raised and the ones we've actually brought up with Senator Murkowski's office. We've also talked to the U.S. Department of Ed. They've recently put out a document where they indicate that they'd like to see some differentiated consequences in the law. I think we have to look at what that language will look at like, though, because keep in mind, you could have a situation where they met the target, and the only reason that school missed is because they were at 93% participation rate in one subgroup. And while we want them to get 95% there, should they have to offer choice and transport students to other schools because they missed by 2 percentage points in one subgroup for participation?
And if I could follow up, Madam Chair, and this is kind of related, but given the rigid recipe that is applied, I mean, and I would expand the context of this a little bit. I mean, limited English proficiency. This may be a greater problem in Arizona than it is in Alaska. I don't know, but given that that is one of the categories, I mean, are we setting up a situation in which the way a district or a school meets the recipe is to discourage these children from attending school in the 11th and 12th grade because they're, and I'm going to give an example here in my community, and I don't want to make the question too complicated, but I would assume that the demographics in Gastineau are probably the Gastineau Elementary School, that there are probably more transient students in that school than there are in other grade schools in Juneau. And it just seems to me, if you have students coming in with limited English proficiency and you have those students for a year, they might be coming in the sixth grade, that what we have here with this rigid recipe is we've set up a circumstance in which Gastineau is always going to be struggling, and they might have the best teachers in Juneau.
Through the chair, Senator yes. Elton, again, I think what you're pointing out is another concern that we have, and one why we believe that if what we were looking at is, instead of did the third, fourth, and fifth graders at Gastineau this year do better than last year, if we were looking at did Johnny do better this year than last year, so we're looking at individual student growth, and that's how we were tracking whether the school was doing a good job with students, would make a lot more sense, because a couple of things have to begin when we're looking at third, fourth, and fifth graders. A third of those students are new. If it's a transient population, we're not tracing, not only a third are new, but more may be new because of the transient nature potentially of that school you just mentioned. So again, we're not giving credit necessarily to the school for the growth they may have caused, whereas if we were looking at individual students, we potentially could be doing that. And again, I said we've applied for growth, and we'll find out in April if we get it. However, the U.S. Department of Ed has put so many tight restrictions around the definition of how they define that growth that unless the law is changed, I don't think that we're going to see effective growth models of looking at addressing the problems you just mentioned, where we're making sure that, yes, they have some transient students, yes, they have some kids that are struggling, but if they are improving the performance of those students, and we're tracing individual students, they're credited for that, and they're credited for it saying they're doing a good job and that they don't face a set of rigid consequences in that case.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair, and I may be missing something fundamental, Les, but I mean, I would assume that in some schools, not just schools in my district, but I would imagine this happens in other urban districts also, where you might have parts of the community where you have more turnover. I mean, a lot of those students are coming in as fifth and sixth graders. And so tracking their progress, I mean, it's easier to track their progress if you have them for 6 years. It's not so easy to track their progress if you have them for 1 or 2 years, and that just seems to me something that's inherently unfair, even if you switch to the new model.
Through the chair, Senator Alton, there is what you mentioned in terms of transients. We do find that in schools, but when we looked at the amount of transients across the state. Most of the students that come in fifth or sixth grade or at a later grade, they often come from another school within the state. So we would have a record from them somewhere in the state and be able to trace how did they do in Angoon last year. And what we're looking at, again, is students who are in the school from October 1 to the first day of testing. That's the students we measure performance on, because if they came in on March, we're not measuring how did the school do with those students, because they didn't have enough time to do a great deal with those students. So a large percentage of our students in this state are transient within the state versus transient from another state. There is a percentage that come in from other states. That is true. But when we've looked at that in terms of being able to, how many kids would be able to major for growth as long as they had a record somewhere in the state the previous year, it's a pretty high percentage. I don't have that number in my head, but I know it was a large number.
Thanks, Lesson. Thanks for the presentation. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Senator Cowher.
Yeah, I was just curious on the dropout rates, say 7th through 12th grade. Where's the high point of dropout, and what about the gender? Is it more males than females that drop out? Do you have any figures like that?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, I don't have those exact figures, but I can get that information to you and have it sent up to the committee and be distributed. Yeah. I do know that we track it by gender and we track it by ethnicity. We also have looked at the grade level that students drop out at, and it, certainly the fewest are in grades 7, 8, and you see more in some of the older grades. In the past, we saw more students dropping out in 10th grade. This last year, I believe the statistics showed us that a large number of students had stayed in till 12th grade, and so we don't necessarily know exactly what that's attributed to. It may be the fact that schools are doing a better job keeping kids in school longer. I'm not sure what that is, but I can get those statistics and get them sent up so you have them.
You don't know the gender, which is biggest, the boys or the girls that drop out?
I don't, Senator. I'm sorry. Not, but I can get that information for you.
And why do they drop out? What is the problem? Is it problems at home? Do you have any idea? Do they leave the state or move to a different district?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, I think that all of the reasons you've mentioned are probably true. I don't know as though there's a particular single reason. I think usually there's going to be problems outside of the school that are as problematic as anything that is causing some of the reasons for a dropout. I know that there is some pretty interesting research in terms of dropouts and when kids make those decisions, and a lot of the behavior that is indicative of dropout begins earlier in the school years, much earlier than high school. And so we want to see what we need to be doing is working on programs that engage those kids early on so that they aren't finding that school is an unsuccessful experience but finding it a successful experience so they stay in. I certainly have experiences. I was a principal for quite a while and a school teacher for quite a while, and I have a sense of why kids drop out, but I think it's just really a combination of many reasons. So I'm not real helpful there.
That's helpful information. If you do have something you want to share with the committee later, we'd be glad to take it. One of the questions is in my mind, and as we were looking at your presentation, you were saying that we are improving in a lot of the areas, but we do have some schools have already got to the level 4. Do we have any schools that we are to the point where we're ready to say we're going to have to restructure those schools, or the state is going to have to come in and take over?
We, Senator Davis, we do have schools where we haven't taken over any schools, but we have worked with some districts that are at the highest levels and have done some pretty heavy interventions where we've gone in, we've laid out what their district professional development plan has to look like. We've gone in and done professional development in those schools for the principals of the district, for all the teachers in the district. We've laid out targets that they've had to meet. Last year, we worked very heavily with one district. This year, we're working very heavily with three districts where we have sent teams that have visited all of the schools to do some of the training, heavy audits of things, those kinds of issues. We have, in some cases, seen where they've worked to change the structure of where decisions are made or how decisions are being made. And in one of the districts that we were very involved with last year, we did see improved results last spring in their tests relative to the previous year. And so we'll be monitoring real closely whether we see that again this year, because when we're intervening, if we're not seeing success, we need to change what we're doing in those interventions.
So basically what you're saying then, that all the schools that you have gone in to help them, you've been successful in helping them turn their situation around. Rather than have to take it towards taking those schools over?
Last year, again, we were involved with one district, and we saw success. There were three schools in that district, and we saw improvement in two of those three schools. We believe, working with the district, we sort of targeted of the other school what probably were the issues. So we have seen success, but we were in one district with three schools last year. We're in three districts with 27 schools this year. Certainly as we ramp up and get involved with more districts and more schools, we hope to be as successful and see those results improve. If we don't, we need to change our direction and what we're doing. At this point, what we've been doing is just getting some very focused in-service and making sure there's coherence in all the schools. In some cases, what we found last year is in one district, each school had a very different plan, and so they weren't even able to use the efficiencies of bringing in professional development where they could all three take advantage of those things. And so in that case, we've been successful in giving them some targeted and focused support.
Are there any other questions at this time? If you don't have, I do have others. Okay. One thing I would like for you to try to point out to the group is, as far as the federal funding that you receive for No Child Left Behind, I would assume that you're not getting what you would consider to be adequate funding. As it started at one level 4 years ago when it went into, and it's that same level of funding that you get each year.
Senator Davis, the funding that I can speak to is the assessment dollars. The federal government pays so much for us to do the assessment component. I can tell you there are a lot more dollars coming into the state as a result of No Child Left Behind than before that, but how much it's increased, I don't know. But I can speak to the assessment dollars, and it has been the same for the last 4 or 5 years. Since the law went into place, there's been the same funding formula for the development of tests. And where that probably becomes the most problematic is if you think about developing a test, one of the biggest expenses to that is to write a question and get it reviewed by committees and get it actually on a test. Well, it costs no less to write a question for Alaska than it does for California, yet our formula, the way the formula works, is much, much smaller. So it has been a challenge at times to make sure that we have the appropriate amount of funding for the testing. The other piece is the purpose behind the funding for the assessment is to develop your assessment. But of course, once you develop, you have to administer it. And development actually is something that's ongoing and so there's ongoing costs there that I think are not necessarily recognized in the law. So there are challenges. At this point, we have delivered a program we think is a good, solid assessment program that, for the most part, I believe educators might not support how the results are used, but I think they have had a lot of buy-in to the development of our tests. We've had probably 10% of the teachers from across the state involved in reviews of questions and those kinds of things. So we built a strong program, but whether it will sustain for a large number of years at the current funding of the assessment from the federal government, would be problematic.
So am I to understand that the rest of the funding that comes for No Child Left Behind goes to the various districts? directly?
There is some funding for administrative things at the department, and then a lot of the dollars are passed through formula grants to the districts. Yes.
I want to take time out to see if there's someone in the audience that might have a question or concern that they would like to discuss or ask. At this time, I don't have anyone signed up to testify. I do see that we have at least one superintendent in the audience from Anchorage School District, and we would like to give you an opportunity to speak if you would like to. Carol, I don't want to put you on the hot seat, but...
Stay right here. Well, thank you, Senator Davis.
You're welcome.
And committee. I just came in at the end, but I want to assure you that we are working very closely with the department and are very much supportive of their trying to get the state of Alaska approved to use the growth model. I can't emphasize enough how important that is to Anchorage, to probably every district in the state, because what we know about teaching and learning is that's what we should be showing. If teachers do a great job of teaching and kids are making progress, even if they don't meet a proficiency bar, but they're showing great progress, to me, that needs to be acknowledged and rewarded, not just kids who are very high to begin with and maybe don't make much progress at all, but they are over the standard. Mm-hmm. So we are very much in support of the growth model, always have been, actually, before No Child Left Behind, when the Quality School Initiative during the Knowles administration, when it all started talking about increased accountability, we were all talking about growth should be measured, not just one test score with a different group of kids every year, which is probably the most frustrating thing for the schools in No Child Left Behind the way it's currently being measured. But the other thing is, I think what Les was saying about the assessment, it's kind of like flat funding. And so we have had to add a significant amount of staff for the assessment department in our district. So here we've got the base student allocation, the general fund, and to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind and the increased accountability, we've had to add assessment staff working obviously very closely with the department. And that's true. We've had to add an accountability person that's monitoring No Child Left Behind in our district in the general fund, because in a district the size of ours with 94 schools, there is no way somebody could have absorbed all that extra commitment. And so I think it's those kind of unintended consequences, maybe, that we're not getting adequate funding from the federal government on No Child Left Behind. And then we add the underfunding of IDEA for special ed, which rolls right in, and English language learners, who are also a factor of all of this. It's gotten much more difficult to provide the instructional services that these young people need and deserve.
Are there other areas that you are interested in sharing that you're hoping that would be addressed in the reauthorization?
Well, I think the whole issue of highly qualified teachers,
yes,
is a challenge. It's bad enough in Anchorage to make sure that every teacher meets all those requirements, but we're in pretty good shape. But when you look at rural Alaska, you look at districts that are K-12, 1-2 teacher schools, they're not going to have a master's degree in every content area. And so I think there needs to be flexibility as to what determines what a highly qualified teacher is. I mean, if they can show students are learning because of the way they're teaching and we give them the right support and mentoring and training and they're doing a good job and kids are learning, to me, that should be satisfactory instead of an artificial requirement that everybody has to have a master's degree or pass a test in each content area, especially in these small schools. And special education staff, it's also problematic for them. So that the highly qualified teacher, the growth model is probably the most significant one,
yes,
for us. And the funding.
Funding for course.
Oh, I guess one other thing. The president has zeroed out the Carl Perkins funding and said, well, we'll put it in to No Child Left Behind and give districts flexibility. So if you really want to have a Carl Perkins funded program, workforce development, voc ed, you can do that, but it's just all going to come out of the same pot. And we don't think that's right at all. We do not think just rolling money in from other very important federal funding, and Carl Perkins is one, Safe and Drug-Free Schools is another, and rolling it all in and saying, okay, see, we're increasing Title I, but they're really zeroing out other funds. We think that's wrong.
I would think that, and I suppose the department will all be putting these things together and pass it along, saying these are the things that we don't support and we hope it doesn't happen.
Well,
I know various...
They will.
Yes.
We have communicated directly with Senator Murkowski's office because she's now on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, or that committee.
Subcommittee,
anyway,
yes.
In the Senate, and I know Karen McCarthy has been working trying to gather information from all the districts, but I'm sure the department is doing the same thing. So I think we're all working very closely to try and bring the issues forward.
Thanks for that input. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Brandon, and I'm from Nome.
Would you come forward and so we can get you on record? And then we're going to...
That's Dr. Pollock who just walked
in. Senator Davis, I'm Tom Brandon. I'm a board member from Nome. I'd like to back up what Carol said about the highly qualified. One part of the highly qualified and different measurement standards is there's nothing that speaks to proficiency. I think that the way it's set up right now, it is done, if you're a good test taker, if you know your information, but it doesn't address how proficient you are at getting your message across and educating the children. So I think a way of doing that with the yearly growth rather than meeting the standards definitely would help us. So just to add that to it, the proficiency section.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, I guess we will close out on our, did you have a closing statement that you would like to make? We'll close out on our presentation for No Child Left Behind. We want to take this opportunity to thank you for coming and presenting to us. And I would like for you to continue to keep us informed on some of the things that you're doing to try to make sure that you're being heard and maybe some of the changes can be made before we reauthorize No Child Left Behind.
Thank you, Senator Davis.
We do have another person that's speaking to us who just arrived. Can't seem to find my paper that has the name on it. Is he? Are you in the room?
I'm Dr. Pollock. Yes.
Dr. Would you come forward?
Thank you.
And would you give your name for the record and tell us what you're going to talk to us about?
Thank you for having me. My name is Dr. William Pollock from Harvard Medical School and McLean Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm going to be talking about the gendered nature of education, how boys are falling behind in Alaska and everywhere, but the trends are starting in Alaska, what has already been done, that's very positive, and what could be done, and how what is sometimes called social and emotional education, the interpersonal connections with those who educate, can have a massive effect not only on the emotional states of boys and girls, but on their academic performance. So I thought I would save the committee, who graciously allowed me to come before you today, too many PowerPoints, and just speak briefly about
okay.
the subject. Just some background for those of you who don't know me. I run the Centers for Men and Young Men at McLean Hospital, which is a teaching facility at Harvard Medical School. I'm on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. I'm a clinical psychologist and a research psychologist, and also do developmental and educational work, particularly around gender, but gender and learning. I'm also a consultant and a principal investigator of one of the studies from the Safe School Initiative, you probably know is the U.S. Department of Education, U.S. Secret Services study on school shootings and how to create safe school climates, threat management, but also climates of what we call mutual respect. And I helped write one of those booklets as well. And we're about to come out with a bystander study, meaning how do we get kids and adults, children in classrooms and their teachers and administrators to interact in a kind of way where they have information they can come
Thank
forward
you.
And provide safety, since no academic learning is possible in an unsafe environment.
what I want to touch on today is, I guess, two things. One is that we are seeing a growing gender disparity in education across this nation, and it's beginning in Alaska as well. Certainly, there are clear disparities amongst certain socioeconomic groups, certain racial and ethnic groups, here amongst Alaskan Native groups, but we are seeing it by gender. And what I mean by that is that, and I should state, I guess, beforehand, that I come from a girl affirmative, boy-friendly perspective, meaning that in speaking for boys, it's because that's what my research is about and that's what we're seeing. It's not in saying that we should in any way scamp girls. But boys, and we see it here in Alaska, young males, are less likely to do well on proficiency exams. If you look at the data, scattered data in Juneau and Anchorage and other towns and cities across Alaska and across the United States, they're more likely to drop out of high school and they're less likely to attend college. And we see this in Alaska as well as across the United States. In fact, federal figures show that in all 50, putting all 50 states data together, that if a male makes it to college, there'll be 100 females for every 77 males. And that's not girl power or women moving ahead, that's boys falling terribly behind. And by the time graduation comes from college, there'll only be 73 males. But those are the entitled few. Most boys will drop out before the 10th grade, certainly before the 12th grade. And as you all know, probably as well, if not better than I, will drift into lives of quiet desperation, into depression and suicide, or into crime and incarceration. Yet, we have the data now, over the last 10 years or so, to show what can work to turn this around. And the data comes both from understanding the differences in gendered learning, and there are such differences. We debate it in academia. I won't bring the whole debate here, but I'll listen to questions and answers and try to answer them about whether this is totally biologically based or it's social, what we call socialization, what we do. Actually, the greatest biologists talk about the fact that it's interconnected, of course. There are biological proclivities that are different than males and females, young and old. But there's also the environment, the human environment, how we respond. And we know, for example, just a few simple facts, that boys learn to read and write between 12 and 16 months on the average later than girls, yet they receive the same curriculum in pre-K and K. And by third grade, many boys are turned off to reading because they feel they have no self-esteem as a reader. And of course, literacy is a fundamental knowledge necessary for any further learning, even mathematical. We also know that boys no longer see school as, quote, cool, or learning as something connected to them. And this brings us to what's historically been called social and emotional education. And sometimes when we talk about that, people's eyes glaze over and they say, well, that's not really No Child Left Behind, that's not really, you know, academic progress, that's just emotions. Well, in fact, we have data to show that the emotional relationship of a student, his connection or her connection to school and learning is one of the primary factors of academic success. And we now have data to show that if we have an environment like the Alaska Association of School Boards has been trying to create, and I know Anchorage is doing some of this, and Juneau is doing some of this, and hopefully it will spread, where those interpersonal connections and climates in the schoolroom and in the school are such that are favorable to kids, and the children feel connected to their adults, not just to other children. These children won't just be happier, healthier adults, less likely to become depressed, less likely to suicide. There's a massive suicide problem amongst boys, Native Alaskan boys the most, but boys across America and boys in Alaska. When I say boys here, I'm talking about from the ages of 10 to 20. Five times more likely to kill themselves than girls. And schools are a place where they often become depressed. But we know that these connections also affect academic progress. It's taken us a long time to get that data, but we didn't link it to any particular state test, because as you know, the state tests for No Child Left Behind vary very considerably from state to state. But we linked them to the SAT scores. Out here, the ACT scores, but the ACT and SAT can be statistically related. And in fact, having a socially competent environment in schools, meaning that teachers understand kids' cultural backgrounds, their emotional needs, their specific gender needs as boys and girls, not only connects them to the teachers, but makes it likely that they'll have higher SAT scores. They will stay in school and graduate and have higher SAT scores and progress better into college. So it's not just psychologists talking about emotional meaning, which I think is important. It's hard data and facts. Indeed, other approaches that just deal with testing models, and there's nothing wrong with assessment, but just deal with testing models, actually fail in comparison to such social, emotional, and culturally oriented teaching methods and understanding the differences in how the two genders learn. And when I talk about boys and girls, I want to be careful here, that I'm talking about the bell curve, 70% girls, 70% boys. There are a lot of boys, well, 30% don't fit into that category. There are a lot of girls who learn more in a classical boy way, and I wouldn't want to tell them they're taking the boy curriculum. But we have to have curricula that recognize those differences so we don't have boys having reading proficiency with a 7% higher chance of being the lowest reading proficiency around. And in national data, which we don't have for Alaska, but in national data, if one thinks that this is just a matter of poverty or class or racial background, which is very important, the most educationally entitled kids that we can get out of federal reports, and this is how the federal government reports the data that you all send into them. There's one category, and it's called student who has at least one parent who has graduated college. In 12th grade, across the entire United States, including Alaska, boys who have one parent who graduated college and have a two-parent family, 23% of them are in the lowest level of proficiency of reading, which means not only that they can't read the New York Times, it means they can't read the headlines, and sometimes they can't even understand how to take direction at a low-level job. And you can see how this moves into the fact that in the 21st century, they can't take any kind of jobs, and they drift away into poor health, into early death and suicide, and sometimes into crime and violence. I think I can give you a lot of data and statistics, and I can send it to the committee, but I think I'll stop here and let the committee ask me questions.
Yes, before I ask for questions, do you have any suggestions on
Yes.
Are you going to get to yes. some of the answers, or do you want to take the questions now if there are some?
I'll make a few suggestions, because we're actually practical. We don't just do research and talk.
Okay.
We actually have some things that work, what we call beta curricula, things
okay.
that we're trying out across the country.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, recognizing that the social and emotional connections are important, we if we have the commitment of the entire state, that's wonderful, if we have the commitment of an entire municipality or school board, we get together with the teachers and talk about that relationships are an essential component of what they're teaching. Not just respect for the teacher or respect for the other kids, but the teacher's respect for them in the sense of understanding their culture, their background, and how they learn. And then we give them the data about culture and background, about the differences in gendered learning. And we have a curricula that works on that. It varies from state to state and from municipality to municipality. And we help the teachers to see that this is a positive move forward. And then we also have, wouldn't be worthwhile, we didn't have any validity data at the end, we have outcome data to show. And unfortunately, we have to do it against a control group that's getting the regular kind of education. But that is the education that we get otherwise. That in those classrooms, the students are more attached to learning, to schools, to teachers, They can get their parents to be more attached to the schools, which is an age-old kind of problem, and support what goes on. The boys start to do better, but the girls continue to do well. The boys and girls treat each other better. And people from different racial, ethnic, and indigenous backgrounds understand that their differences are diversity, not something strange and uncomfortable. So teaching the teachers this is very important. We have curricula that actually teach about empathy and understanding from kindergarten onward, and we connect it with educational reading styles. Boys like nonfiction and girls like stories about something, and we can get the same kind of message across in those different pieces. For boys, for years, they would read comic books and catalogs, and they'd be thrown out of school. The librarian would say, this isn't hard literacy. We now know that if we allow them to do that for the first 3 years in a supervised kind of manner, by the third year, they have so-called, the literacy says, morphed into hard literate reading. And in fact, they do better on the reading scores than boys who were taught in the classical kind of way. And the girls are excited by the fact that the boys seem as intelligent as they are. in relation to the relationship aspect, we have data and we have interventions that particularly tell elementary school teachers, although this is important all the way through, you know, K through 12 and post-secondary, but it starts early on, although it can be fixed later, why not prevent it earlier. We talk with the elementary school teachers that if they have a negative feeling towards a child, they need to understand it. I mean, boys particularly tend to move around more, which some people call acting out, and I call gross motor behavior based on male genetic socialization. And so we create moving classrooms where the kids can actually, boys and girls, these are co-educational environments, have chairs like these, smaller versions, where they can roll around and have periods of time. They can have brain banks in the back of the corner while the teacher's teaching. They can actually go to the computer, which is set up with certain educational material, and to video games, and eye-hand coordination, and do it. We now have data to show that even though what's on the computer is something that interests them educationally, but not the exact curriculum, those boys tend to score better on the tests about the curriculum at the end of that section than the boys who sat in their chairs. We give more recesses to younger boys, and then the girls notice what the boys are doing, and they become excited by that as well, and so we don't have the typical gender separation and bullying and negativity and meanness that goes on in so many schools around the country, and dare I say, in Alaska as well. But I'll stop there.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Yes, Senator Elton?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks, Doctor, for the presentation. I mean, I've got a mind that began noodling almost as soon as you started, and I'm going to say something, and you can tell me whether or not I heard correctly. But it seems, and I'll start by saying that I'm a fan of the goals of No Child Left Behind. I'm a fan of the goal of exit exams, but I sometimes question the rigidity of both. And am I hearing correctly when am I hearing you suggest that because of the gender differences, that curricula and maybe some of the assessment tools that we're using are making it more difficult for male students, and in fact may lead to them becoming academically discouraged with the potential consequences that you've mentioned?
With one exception, I would say absolutely yes. And it's safe to say it because I've gone around with Mrs. Bush talking about this. So I guess they talk to each other about No Child Left Behind. No, I mean, we have to assess what's going on. We have to see how No Child Left Behind can work. But if you have criteria, they have to come from something valid, not just something we've believed in our minds for 20 years. So if boys are going to learn a certain way or not be in a certain point until third grade, and girls are going to be there in fourth grade, and we test them in third grade in the same kind of way, not only are they going to fail, and the state's going to look bad when they're trying their hardest, but they don't have the right kind of curricula, but the boys are going to turn off. The only thing, and I don't think you meant to say this, but I just want to be clear on my end, I don't think it favors girls. I just think it makes for a mixture that's poor for boys.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
And this can be connected with No Child Left Behind. There's nothing in No Child Left Behind that wouldn't allow any of these interventions to get more children not left behind.
Well, to that point, yeah. I mean, I would assume that the way you begin, I hesitate to use the word correcting, but the way you begin to address the issue, I mean, I would assume that a lot of that has to begin as you're educating teachers, that's the easiest way of doing it, rather than trying to retrain teachers, for example, who are in the schools now.
Well, I take the perspective that prevention is always, positive prevention is always better than intervention, but we should be doing this simultaneously. I mean, those who are already out there shouldn't be lost. There should be intervention that's supportive for them and for the kids. But our schools of education need to be doing this as well, absolutely.
Are they doing it?
I can easily say that about 50% of the graduates of the Harvard School of Education have not learned about the same material that some of my colleagues are writing about right now. So, no, we're very poor in doing that.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Vic.
I'm just curious, how many children do you have?
I have one child, who's a daughter.
Boy?
Girl.
Oh, girl.
But I've worked with over 500,000 boys.
I see. Thank you.
Yes. Senator Tompkins.
Thank you, Senator Davis. It's, we know we live in a less structured world, and you know, because we're spreading out doing all kinds of different things. Education is very different today than it was before. Kids learn differently. Although it seems that when we're trying to educate, and I'm not saying this for sure because I don't know that much about No Child Left Behind, but it seems like it is becoming more structured almost to try and assess people based on almost a structured kind of restrictive situation, when in fact your research shows that we probably should be loosening things up, which I suppose concerns some school districts to say, well, if we do that, it's going to cost more because we're going to have to allow these other things to take place. We're going to have a looser classroom rather than a more structured one. But some people for a long time have felt that if you allow someone to learn at their own pace and to pursue what they want, you will have more success with them individually in life, in all aspects of life. Yet we struggle with the budgets to determine how we keep these things all kind of in place and move forward and mix it all together, which, and sometimes you suggest things, and not you in particular, but people suggest things that seem so different that people just overreact to it and say we can't possibly do that.
Let me start first with No Child Left Behind. The aims of No Child Left Behind, the essential enabling legislation, are all very, very positive things that will move our nation forward. How it gets implemented, however, goes to those who implement, and there's nothing wrong with making a mistake in the first set round of implementation, and that's life. But we are making mistakes in implementation. In other words, when we do narrow the force in the sense that teachers complain endlessly that they're teaching to the test, and parents complain that, and I have to tell you that I see kids in poverty, and I see kids of entitlement. And in areas where kids of entitlement, who stayed in very good public schools, when No Child Left Behind was in for 3 or 4 years, the parents removed them from those schools and put them into private, church-based, or charter-based schools because they didn't have to take those same tests. In other words, the best learners were removed from our public school system because their parents and, of course, the other schools felt that they could have a more free way of learning. So I wouldn't say loosening it. I would say adapting it to the way kids learn. And I mean, it looks like I come from Harvard, and I do, but I was born in Brooklyn, so I'm a realist and a pragmatist, and I know what a dime's worth, although a dime's worth a penny now. But the models we have with graduate students being involved, writing their dissertations, doing it, et cetera, can be implemented for no cost dollars. In other words, this manner of teaching, this manner of changing curriculum, this manner of helping teachers and what they do in the classroom might cost a minimal amount, but it will not cost more. That's one of the wonderful things about it. In costing no more, it will bring so much more.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess we don't have very much time, but I'm going to say this. The curriculum and the things that you were talking about that can be done, you said it doesn't take any money, but I would agree that the techniques have to be taught to the teachers in order to be able to carry them out. And it's not necessary that this should happen within the classroom. It should happen in the learning stages while they were in college. And I suppose that's happening around the states now, because there are more and more people seeming to be concerned about our boys. But that's the same thing that was there for the girls when we were saying that the girls were lagging behind or not being pushed forward. And many organizations, women groups, and people have come forward and helped them move beyond that. I was at a meeting back in Anchorage in maybe September, and I was only about 5 minutes late getting there. But when I got to East High School, cars were everywhere, and the building was packed. And they came there for the same thing that you were just talking about, to hear about what we can do to teach boys that would move them ahead, because they're having problems with their young men. And the place was just packed, and people were standing. And they had books for sales and other things that they were selling at the time. It was a very good procedure. So it's not like you're the only one that's got that. It's a concern around the state. And I do believe that we do have to do what's in the best interest of females and males. And so your concept, I can buy them. Just on based on some of the things I heard that night, they said you can be telling, giving direction to them to do something, and the students. And the girls would catch it maybe right away, and they have no problem, and they start doing the work right away. And maybe the boys might have to come up and ask two or three times. But once you do it in a different way, where they can understand it better, they could do it just as fast as the girls and just as well as the girls. So we do have to look at things like that. And I appreciate your concerns. I suppose that apparently someone must have invited you to come to our state, or did you come on your own?
The University of Alaska Northern Studies Program and Voice Project, Dr. Kleinfeld.
And maybe it's something that they feel that they need to add into their curriculum is they teach teachers how to teach our students.
I think you're absolutely right, Senator. The only thing I would say is that teachers need continuing education credit and continuing education as they go along. And if the state and the municipalities see that there are these curricula, if they see that Anchorage is starting to experiment, if they see the Alaska Association of School Boards being supportive, these courses will be the ones they take, and they'll feel better. What you see when you teach teachers, I mean, who've been in the field for a while, is this amazing set. They come in very unsure and frightened they're going to be attacked and told they're not doing a good job and all this. And they come out feeling, well, I'll try this. And then we usually do a session a month or two later. Just a month or two later, we're not talking years later. And they talk about how much more revived they feel in their teaching. And they haven't been paid, like me for this, but they haven't been paid one more dollar in the teaching. And the kids haven't been bribed to do it. And boys and girls succeed. And not only in school, but in life.
Yes. Well, Senator, thank you for taking the opportunity to come and speak with us. And if we have no other questions or comment to make at this time, we're going to adjourn at 3:05.
Thank you very much for having me.